there. Now, here we go. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be taken into the world of whalers, courtesy of my morning show guest, Alexander R. Brash, and his great-great-grandfather, Robert Armstrong. In a sense, these two men, who lived, of course, generations apart from one another, have co-authored this book called A Whaler at Twilight, a long-lost true account of whaling and redemption in the South Pacific. Alexander Brash was given a long-forgotten, or at least sort of long-hidden-away manuscript, more than 150 years old, that had been written by his great-great-grandfather, Robert Armstrong, recounting, among other things, his adventures on the high seas on a whaling ship. And Alexander Brash eventually read this, was fascinated by what he read, and set about to write a book that could somehow bring this long-ago account of the life of whalers to the public, and does so with this new book. Alexander Brash's own resume includes a stint as chief park ranger for New York City Parks, where he initiated a couple of important initiatives. He then joined the National Parks Conservation Association as its Northeast regional director. And this book, once again, is titled A Whaler at Twilight, A Long-Lost True Account of Whaling and Redemption in the South Pacific. And Mr. Brash, before I forget, I neglected to write down the name of the publisher.
Lions Press.
Lions Press. Very good.
Lions Press.
And Alexander Brash, we welcome you to the morning show.
Very good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about the book, I would like to take a couple of minutes to talk about sort of your work as a conservationist. If I remember correctly from reading your biography, your love of kind of the outdoors and the natural world sort of began with a love of and fascination with birds. Am I right?
It did. It did. It really began for some really unknown reason. About age 10, I became fascinated with birds and ended up getting a couple of jobs through high school and college working at the Museum of Natural History in New York, which is really what opened up my eyes to this book and what it foretold, in that there were a couple of murals, one including the pelagic seabirds off New Zealand and others around the Cape Horn, that really attracted my attention. And after a stint in sort of ornithological research world, I then went and worked for the World Wildlife Fund down in Washington, D.C., came back and did a couple of years in grad school, and somewhere in there sort of had my own epiphany that it would be impossible to save the species and the world's biodiversity unless we also really educated and brought more of it home to everybody. And in that sense, I wanted to bring it back to New York City, the city that I was born and raised in, and try to, you know, help build an environmental awareness and considerations among the city's population. And so from that, I ended up in a job with the New York City Parks Department. It was park ranger, chief park ranger for 15, 20 years, and then jumped over to the National Parks gig, which was National Parks Conservation Association is a wonderful nonprofit, and it's really focused on representing the an independent, shall we say, point of view in support and defense of the national parks. And in there, then, that also really awakened my inclinations towards this story in particular, because one of the things I realized is while most people consider our national park system, really thinking about, let's say, the 63 iconic national parks like Yellowstone, Yosemite, you know, in fact, there's more than 150 historic sites, and each historic site, you know, captures American's tale and tales of individual humans who did something to make America such a great place. And, you know, that really woke me up to this story. In fact, when I came upon it, was, you know, it's also the tale of, you know, an individual who headed out of New Bedford, which is a national park site in itself, and you know, it was his tale of really trying to find himself, a tale of redemption. And as you said, it stretches over actually five generations. And so it's actually very fitting on a day like today, Valentine's Day, because it really is also a story of family and connections and relationships. And it's a beautiful tale at that. And thank God at the end of it, he came home.
Right.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be around.
You're right, exactly. It's a remarkable story on a whole lot of different fronts. And yeah, one of the things that I especially like about the book is that on the one hand, it's kind of an epic canvas that sort of takes us back in history, but it's also a very personal story. We'll touch on it in just a moment. If I may, I just want to ask you about a couple of things that you have done in your work as a conservationist. One of them, as chief park ranger for New York City Parks, you initiated something called the Forever Wild Project. Could you explain to our listeners what that was about?
Sure. You know, New York City Parks has roughly 26,000 acres of parks among 1,800 sites, and some of them are just small, if you will, small little plots where streets intersect and there might be a couple of trees. But obviously there's some great parks, Pelham Bay Park, Central Park, Prospect Park, and so forth. And a number of them also still have remnants of really wild areas, so to speak, and they've been sort of left that way. They have not been totally manicured and stuff. And so with a good friend and partner of mine at the Parks Department, who was running the Natural Resource Group, guy called Mark Matzel, we sort of came together under the commissioner at the time, and came up with the notion of sort of setting aside some of these areas, working with the maintenance folks who are all over the city's parks to sort of help preserve them and set them aside and not mow the lawns and so on and so forth. And then also work with all the great parks partners are throughout the city, and volunteers will come in and get them to help remove invasive species and so forth. But really designate these as forever wild sites, much as in the national park system, you might have wilderness areas. It was sort of a similar concept. And we successfully did that, and they exist today, and they're actually taken care of by their own nonprofit. So I think that's been very successful. And then that led us to the second big project we undertook, which was a little more controversial at the time, but is actually fairly simple. And that was sort of reintroducing some of the lost species. You know, and it turned out one wouldn't have thought about it, but in the turn of the century, when Robert Moses and various others were sort of rebuilding or building some of these parks, you know, they often brought in bulldozers in the middle of the winter to redo the landscape. And in doing that, they buried ponds and so forth. And so a lot of very simple species, frogs, salamanders, and obviously a lot of plants all disappeared. And so one of our goals was really to go back and do the background research and figure out what was there, what ought to be there, and bring some of them back. And we worked with New York State to get all the permits in order and brought everything in. And one of the highlights was actually Isabella Rossellini came around and helped us reintroduce screech owls to Central Park. So, you know, but there were a lot more nondescript species that we managed to put back in out in Brooklyn, Queens, and Bronx, and so forth.
That was Project X, correct?
Project X.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Alexander R. Brash, and we're about to begin now speaking in earnest about his new book, which is called A Whaler at Twilight, A Long-Lost True Account of Whaling and Redemption in the South Pacific. This book takes us back to the mid-19th century and to the exploits of his great-great-grandfather, Robert Armstrong. So I guess we need to begin this part of the interview by hearing about this intriguing manuscript that somebody placed in your hands. Tell us when this happened and how this happened and with whom this happened.
So the manuscript first appeared in a conversation back in my youth, frankly, in my 20s, late 20s, and I was a grad student, and I'd for the first time gone on a whale watching trip. I had partnered with another grad student who knew all about marine mammals, and we were taking a group of people off of to Stellwagen Bank, which is a fantastic whale site off of the tip of Cape Cod off Provincetown. And on that trip, I was supposed to talk to everybody about the birds, and my partner was talking to everybody about the whales. But for the first time, or for me at least, came face to face with a whale that rose, a beautiful humpback whale that rose right to the surface and frankly stared at us on our boat for quite a while. And it just evoked in me such empathy and such a sensitivity to the whales and how beautiful they were, but also how intelligent they were. And so I went home and I sort of picked up the phone and told my parents I'd been on this trip and the whale was really cool. And my mother said, well, you know, there's a whaler in your background. And I said, oh, well, that's nice. What's about it? And she said, oh, I don't know, there's a letter somewhere. And it kind of all went away. And then I kept going in my, you know, youthful way and focused on trying to get a job and so on through life. And, you know, ultimately embarked on my career and married and had kids. And, you know, life leads on to life and way leads to way. And I sort of put it aside. And then I finally had some time later and I came back to it a couple of years ago. And I went back to my mother, and God bless her soul, at 97. She's still around and still doing well. And I said, so, Mom, what is this thing? And she said, well, come here. And so she took me in the back of her closet, buried under this pile of clothes, was this black leather chest with big brass hinges, and she had me pull it out, and there inside the first thing was her dancing shoes, and then the next layer down had stuff from my grandfather, and it was his surveying equipment because he served in the Army and during World War One. And then at the very bottom were these sort of couple of coffee stained or blood stained, I couldn't tell what they were, pages and stuff, and I pulled all that out. And it was at first hard to read because it was a Xerox of an old copy. And then I tried going through that. It didn't work. And I went back to her a couple of weeks later. I said, Mom, I really just can't read it. He says, well, go dig deeper. And there was another copy, which I could read. And it was a copy that my grandfather had made in the 1930s. And it was more like a mimeograph. If you remember your childhood days when they used to have those whirling purple machines that spat out copies that were reverse-sided, really. And so this was that equivalent from the 1930s, and it was white writing on black paper, but it turned out to be his 100-page handwritten autobiography of his time. And he had gone off on his sailing adventure, so to speak. And I think probably as one of the few literate people on board, kept logbooks on his two ships. And then much later in life, in his 60s, he sat down and, taking his logbooks, wrote this sort of 100-page account of what had gone on. And so that is what I pieced together. And then I spent the next really 3 years diving into background research and context and trying to follow up on all the proper nouns and the places he went and the people he intersected with, the other whaling ships and the ports that he was in. And, you know, also trying to get a real understanding of whaling in the heyday, as well as, you know, a piece of American history. It was sort of a national expansionism.
So this manuscript, in what form was it? And as far as you could tell, you know, once you were able to actually read it, with what intention was it probably written? I mean, did it seem like it was more like a journal for his own enjoyment, or did it seem like it had been written in a way that was intended to be shared with others?
I think the latter. At the end of the day, though, there is one line in there where he says, well, I'm not writing this with the intention to go out widely. And then the other line is, this is something I want to share with you, you know, and I think he left it to his family. My guess is, one, he did keep logs for himself on the journeys, and that's what he used. And they are separate. I mean, they are actually now up at the New Bedford Whaling Museum in the library. There's a couple of his log books, and he kept those separately. And they were very detailed from his time on the two ships, time, places, who he met, you know, very exacting. His time while he was a logger in New Zealand, which was about four and a half years, is sort of what he recollected. He clearly wrote this in the 60s. My guess, reading between the lines, was he was a devout Methodist, and I think he hearkened it to sort of what one of the early Methodist founders had done. It was written in a sort of account of himself and sort of posed it as his story of redemption. And I think he did it as something to leave to his kids as his story of redemption, and how he started out young, his parents died when he was early, his one kind but rather stiff, upper-lipped, stark uncle, regardless, took him in and helped finish raising and got him through the nation's first dental school. And then, by his own account, he fell in with a bad crowd and became a drunkard. And he struggled with alcoholism for the next 15 years, more or less. And, you know, I think he then finally embarks on this tale. And when he gets back, he sort of finds redemption on the way home, which we can come back to. But I think he wrote the tale to sort of his tale of that redemption and how, you know, he was able, in his notion through God, I think in reality, through actually finally finding the self-discipline to re-put his life right back on the rails, but saved himself. And then, you know, came back ultimately to Baltimore, where he'd grown up and was a changed person, and ended up with a good job and finally got married. And you know, much to my great luck, had six kids, of which I'm the product of the oldest.
So. So you had this manuscript from him to look at and draw information from. And you've already mentioned the fact that there were these other things that he wrote, the log books, which I think you were able to examine in their pretty much their entirety in New Bedford, from which this whaling ship had sailed so many years ago. Tell us what these logbooks are and what they look like and the kind of information that they would contain that, for instance, this other manuscript by your great-great-grandfather did not.
Well, so there were a couple of miracles in putting together this tale, you know, and as I said, I myself was a grad student in ornithology and ecology and spent a number of years in two grad schools, both the Yale and Rutgers, and, you know, I'm deeply into research. And so when I got the manuscript, I was fascinated by the context. I kind of looked at it as a nonfiction companion to Moby Dick. But in this case, everything that happened was true, you know, and it was fascinating to dig into. So among other things, I leaned back, and it turned out as a grad student, I still could access an online thing called JSTOR, which is this fascinating repository. And it is amazing now in the last 10 years how much stuff is online. And I could find, you know, original accounts in the 1840s of his contemporaries and others. And then I also was fascinated enough, because it was, you know, my ancestor and his life that I dug into, and I went and paid a couple of visits down to Baltimore to see where he lived and so forth. And then I went up to New Bedford, and I went to the New Bedford Whaling Museum and went to their library and sort of said, I'm here to find out some background on the Smyrna and the Howland ship, the other ship that he was on. And they were like, well, okay, we've got lots of stuff. Here's some indexes and so forth. And who are you backtracking? And I said, well, I'm looking at this guy, Robert Armstrong. And they said, well, we have his logbooks. I said, you what? Well, there's probably lots of Robert Armstrongs, you know, blah, blah, blah. It turned out that when, again, my surmise is that when he died in 1902, that the kids, as they would, in a family, break up the possessions of who wants what personal possessions. And so the oldest daughter on my side, she took the 100-page handwritten autobiography, and three kids down the line, the next daughter took one of his logbooks that he'd written on one of the ships, and the youngest son took the other logbook. And they all knew enough that even in my grandfather's time, the middle daughter wrote to her younger brother and said, can I borrow your logbook? And I'm going to make a copy. And so she made this copy. Early half of it is handwritten and half of it is Xerox, so to speak, and glued on the pages. And she kept that and ultimately then sent back one of the logbooks. That one is lost. But ultimately that middle daughter's great-grand-daughter-in-law, when she was in her late 90s back in 2006, realized no one in the family cared about them. And so she sent the two logbooks that she had, one an original and one a copy, to the Whaling Museum. And so when I got there and found them, and it was, you know, it was an epiphany for me. It was an amazing miracle to find this thing that matched exactly what I had in hand, and realize that what I had in hand was written, you know, when he was rereading those or reconsulting those later in life.
Wow. So those logbooks look like what? I mean, and what do we find there?
One is actually sort of a, you know, turn of the century account book, if you will, with a bunch of columns and some faint red and blue lines where you'd account for things. And he just used the lines and wrote through. One of them is much more like a more typical whaling logbooks, where he actually had created sort of little stamps. And the two things that... The three things that all whale books seem to log, real log books accounted for, were one, where you were every day. So the captain, you know, would monitor latitude and longitude, and, it, you know, at dawn we're here and at sunset we're here. They also always monitored, obviously, the whales they took. And so they have a little stamp on that mirrored how big the whale was and how many that it was taken or how many were taken and how many barrels of oil it gave out. And a great big sperm whale, a big bull sperm whale might bring you up to 100 barrels of oil, where typically most whales got you about 30 or 40, and then every once in a while they would take some little baby whale that would give you 5 barrels, and it would make my heart weep, but in any event. And then the other thing that they always tracked is when they gammed, which is when two whaling ships would get together and for an evening, and they would relax, and the ships would lower their sails and drift next to each other, and the crews would go back and forth on boats, and they would swap tales and share whatever books they had or newspapers. And so it was a sort of social interaction. And so they always kept track of who and when they gammed with another ship. And those were sort of in one of his books. That was a very typical whaler's logbook. And that's what one of them was like.
We're speaking with Alexander R. Brash about his new book, A Whaler at Twilight, a long-lost true account of whaling and redemption in the South Pacific. The book is, in a sense, co-written by Alexander Brash and by his great-great-grandfather, Robert Armstrong, because a significant portion of the book is essentially this manuscript, more than 150 years old, in which Robert Armstrong chronicled some of his experiences as a whaler. Your great-great-grandfather, as we may be mentioned a little earlier, was born in 1828, lost his parents. His uncle takes him in. His uncle is a very successful store owner. And your great-great-grandfather enters what I understand to be one of our country's very first dental schools, but as you characterized it, fell in with the wrong crowd and began abusing alcohol in a way that kind of left him losing essentially everything. How much, if at all, does your great-great-grandfather talk about this part of his story? That is kind of his personal kind of self-destruction, which of course sets in motion then what you describe as his redemption. How much, if at all, does he get into that?
A lot, which is surprising. One of the aspects of the book is the details he gets into on that front, and other details he avoids, on conservation stuff. But he certainly talks very explicitly, you know, early on about his loss of his parents and how devastating it was to him. He talks about trying to, you know, make things right in his younger years, and he's part of this local church, and he gets involved in setting up a new church for seamen in Baltimore, whose remnants still exist today. And then he, you know, talks about falling in with a bad crowd without naming any of them, surprisingly, because he names his friends on the good stuff. But then he is very emphatic about how, you know, he couldn't restrain himself and how he fell into the quote-unquote devil of alcohol and lost his two jobs and, you know, his two dental partners. The first one, he leaves the Baltimore Dental School and he heads out west to Kentucky, and he crosses the Appalachians in a stagecoach. And what's amazing is the night before, on the same stagecoach, the driver on top froze to death and died. I mean, that's how, you know, early, what an early slice of Americana this is.
Wow.
And he portrays the whole thing. So it's fascinating on that level. But in any event, you know, his partner catches him riding drunk through the town a few too many times and says, look, you got to go. You're ruining our practice. So he goes back to Baltimore the first time and he's embarrassed, obviously. And school takes him in and the faculty, you know, gather around and say, okay, we'll help you. And he stays sober for a couple of months and they get him a new job and he goes down to South Carolina. And sure enough, within a couple of months, he's riding around South Carolina drunk on the horseback and his partner again says, you know, no, this is not good. You're ruining my practice. You're out of here. And at that point, he is too embarrassed. And he makes it very clear. He's just too embarrassed to go home. He's too embarrassed to reconnect. He doesn't even tell his uncles in Baltimore. And he just goes straight to New York and drinks himself around the table for two nights and sells his tools to pay for the last round of liquor. And then winds up in the streets penniless in the morning. And so he then sells himself, you know, signs up. It's kind of like it's the equivalent of going to Times Square today and signing up with the army if you're penniless, you know, which you can still do. And so, you know, he did that and ends up being put on a train to go to New Bedford and heads off for 10 years at sea.
Is it your sense that he opted for the life of a whaler because there were no other viable options for him? Or is it more that he was drawn to that for some reason? I mean, that he actually found the notion attractive?
Yeah, no, I think he went on for the former. That is, I think he went sort of as an everyman, and he didn't know what to do with his life. And it was, in essence, I think as many Americans today, you know, a lot of people join the armed forces because it's a way up and it's a way out. And if you go there, you know, you'll get, you know, a solid food, some training, it'll be a step up and out. And I think he went because he didn't know what else to do, because he certainly never expresses any great particular interest in whaling or sea or any of that stuff through the book. I mean, he writes about it, but he doesn't really dive into it with some great fondness. And on that score, as a conservationist myself, it always struck me that what he doesn't discuss in the book are some of the sort of awful things. I mean, he avers from discussing, you know, the hard part of whaling, the slicing up and the dicing up and the killing and so forth. He tries to keep it on a sort of a more romantic level, if you will, on a Herman Melville kind of level. And he certainly does discuss, you know, for instance, they stop in the Galapagos Islands for 10 days early on the voyage out. And he never says really what they did there other than gambling with a few ships. But every whaling ship that stopped there in those days went to kill and gather the rare Galapagos tortoises, which they use for food and meat. And they, you know, some they would immediately kill and eat. And most of them they would gather up and tie them up and put them on their ships upside down and take them to sea. And that was, you know, fresh meat for the next 6 months. And he doesn't discuss that awful practice. So, you know, I think perhaps later in life, being at that point now re-involved in the church, he began to sort of redefine his ethical and moral lines as he, you know, as he considered how to position his story.
Right. We're speaking with Alexander R. Brash about his new book, A Whaler at Twilight, A Long-Lost True Account of Whaling and Redemption in the South Pacific. So he heads off to New Bedford, Massachusetts, which was, in essence, the whaling capital of the world at that point in time. Tell us more about New Bedford and the whaling industry that was, in a sense, such an indispensable part of its economy and its identity at that point in time.
Well, New Bedford, fascinatingly, was also a nexus for a growing racial awareness in the nation, which was, you know, improbable to think about. But indeed, it began with the whaling industry early in the 18th century, when, in fact, as the first sort of European colonists, settlers, or whatever, were working out of Nantucket and so forth, they knew how to sail ships, really didn't know about whaling. And so they relied on the Native Americans to teach them. And so from its very inception, whaling was a much more diverse and open-minded, if you will, labor pool And it carried that forward. And so by the time you get to the quote-unquote golden era of whaling, in which my great-great-grandfather was involved in New Bedford, New Bedford was also, you know, a very egalitarian nation. In fact, that's where Frederick Douglass went on purpose, because it was very open-minded about both religion and race and was very accommodating. And so it was, you know, in many ways a haven for a lot of people. And that's, you know, where he went. And so the ships headed out from there with mixed crews. And he heads, you know, he finally lands there and sails off in the middle of the winter. I mean, he sails off a few days after Christmas, and they talk about icicles hanging from the rigging and so forth. But, you know, with a few days, they're south and crossing the equator and heading around the Horn on his journey.
Hmm. One thing that is interesting about his experience is, first of all, kind of all of the places he sees, but also some of the experiences that are a part of this, with desertions and mutinies and floggings, and I mean, it's there are aspects of this that we sometimes forget were a very real part of it, and it's so interesting to have a firsthand account of, in a sense, the turmoil that was not just the stormy seas, but the turmoil even aboard these ships and between the men.
It's a crazy, rollicking tale of his time. And you're absolutely right, Gregory. That's what he pointed out. I think a lot of the book he focused on his side. He focused on the people that he was with and their relationships. And exactly, she said, who came and who left. He certainly talks about a mutiny that he and the crew stumble into the middle of, and it actually turned out to be a very sort of famous mutiny in the area. It encompassed two ships in almost 5 years, and a captain who gets left on an island and so forth, and finally is resolved. He talks about how when a couple of their crew members desert and they're in the Fijis, that the captain thinks nothing of just grabbing a couple of Fiji Islanders off the beach, so to speak, and kidnapping them, putting them on board against their will, and hey, you're coming with us, and we're heading offshore. They didn't like aspects, so they shaved their heads because they were covered in lice, and you know, they put these guys to work, who of course had no interest in going to work, had no interest in living with these people, and wanted to go home. Sadly, the two guys, after a couple of nights, jump overboard 40 miles offshore of the Fijis. They jump overboard one night in the dead of the evening and swim. And they're like, well, they assume they're lost, of course. And about a couple of weeks later, they go back into the islands and discover that the two guys, in fact, made it to the island. Oh, but sadly, they made it to the wrong island. Mm. And the custom of the Fijis, if the wrong people from the wrong tribe land on the wrong island, they were eaten. So, you know, it also opened up his eyes to the whole notion that cannibalism was you know, fading then, but still active in Fiji. And then, you know, the other great thing is whalers loved to sit around when they were gamming and talk about other ships that had been, you know, the crews had either been lost to mutinies or something else, or particularly islanders who revolted or islanders who attacked them, and how, you know, awful it was. Well, I then spent a lot of time, because there were a bunch of these stories, and in digging into it, it turned out in almost every single case that, in fact, if that ship hadn't, some previous ship had done something awful to the islanders, and so whatever happened was sort of in retribution for a perceived previous event, whether it was, you know, kidnapping as happened with his ship, or whether it was, you know, frankly, rape or whatever else. You know, there were awful interactions, and it turned out as an interesting slice in American history, this whole time, the golden age of whaling, was really in a new era of American history, expansionism, and we were sort of past the founding fathers clutch on that, and you moved into Andrew Jackson and the notion of, you know, 40 acres and a mule and expand across the Midwest and the West, and the nation was still trying to do the same in the Pacific Ocean, and we'd sent out a fleet of our Navy who had gone to a number of the islands and sort of had followed up on individual stories of people abused without doing any research, without any justice, without any real effort of trying to find out the details. They would go after various chiefs of the tribes on the islands and lock them up or haul them away. And, you know, when I pursued a whole bunch of these stories, in every case, you know, a ship previously had gone in, kidnapped the women, or, you know, stolen from the islanders and so forth. And so, you know, all these things were really in retribution. And so it was a very interesting, you know, his tale for me opened up a very interesting and deep dive into sort of an early phase of American history and a phase of, you know, if you will, first contacts. I mean, the whalers were some of the first contacts on these islanders. And it, you know, it set a tone.
You already have mentioned the fact that your great-great-grandfather does not go into much at all in terms of the grisly details of how whaling was done and what was done to these beautiful creatures by the whalers. You, however, in researching this book and trying to give us a full account, did explore some of the details of how whaling was carried out at this point in time. I think at one point you say, killing a whale was a maritime bullfight, a long, drawn-out, and barbaric affair. I don't think we need to nor should go into any of the really painful details of this. We leave it to our listeners to explore that on their own. But I wonder just what it was like for you as a conservationist to do this research and to learn more about this. I should think it was a really painful experience of discovery for you.
It was painful. It was painful. And, you know, on the whaling side alone, as I said, at one point, I sort of call it a whaling primer, but I did a chapter on the history of whaling. You know, and it starts with obviously indigenous populations around the world who were whaling, which made sense for early sustenance. And then, you know, you move through into the classic golden area of Nantucket and New Bedford, and it's sort of the Herman Melville, Moby Dick whaling, and it's still this romantic, and it's mano a mano and so forth, and you can get some element, and then it just turns awful, because by the end of really, about the time that my great-grandfather comes back, you know, oil has been discovered in the hills of Pennsylvania and southern New York, and so we're moving away from the need of whale oil, and plastics and steel begin taking it over for the use of whale bone, which was sort of a structural alternative in the early days, and there was no need for it. And then it quiets down a little bit. The gold rush quieted because it pulled away the labor market, and then you move into World War One and World War Two, which really you know, had everyone obviously preoccupied. And at that point, you know, humans don't need whale oil, they don't need whale meat. And yet, at the end of World War II, is this just awful period where all of a sudden, with the, you know, power-driven ships and steel hulls, the ability to penetrate both the Arctic and the Antarctic and the ice area where the whales, the last whales, have been hiding, and the ability on these, you know, a new steam-driven ship to have the speed to now race down blue whales and sei whales and species they couldn't have caught in the past, the fin whales. Now they go after them. And, it turned out to be really just a few, frankly, countries with very cultural-centric ideas that they were preserving something. What I really call it is the tragedy of the commons, and that is, I think, a few places, you know, viewed it as free meat. It wasn't owned by anybody, and so they could take as much as they want and bring it back. And so, you know, together you have Japan and the Soviet Union and Norway and a few others continuing on with the tradition that really was totally unnecessary. And it drove the populations to incredibly dangerously low levels, if not near extinction. I mean, the blue whales have never really recovered. They were up at somewhere around 100,000+, and now they're at best a few thousand spread around the world. And you know, one theory is it's hard for them to find each other. There's so few of them to mate. Right. The right whales have been nearly driven to extinction. The scrag whale was, and so forth. Some of them have slowly come back, but now Now we're actually out competing them. So instead of hunting them down individually, finally conservationists got involved in the 70s and, you know, began getting us out of the whaling business. But now what's gone on is, you know, Chinese taking the lead, but various countries are going out and harvesting the krill that the whales eat, and the small fish and so forth. And so now we're out competing the whales without giving any real thought. I mean, we haven't even set up preserves or areas we might leave or population. We're not really even thinking about it that way. Mm-hmm.
I do appreciate that you not only talk about this really sort of awful side of it, but at one point you also do kind of explore what it took for whaling to be done. I mean, not to excuse it, not to elevate it into kind of the realm of heroism, but nevertheless, you write at one point, killing a great whale required superb skill, considerable strength, and good luck. And certainly plenty of whalers perished in the attempt. And it was no small matter. And do I remember correctly, we keep talking about the men who did this, but it wasn't all men. There were women who also engaged in this industry. I assume not very many, but a few.
Yeah, not very many. Not very many. There was one famous woman who did, but she actually was pursuing, a whaler had come back to her town, as I recollect, it was in Massachusetts. But anyway, they'd had a love affair. She thought he was going to marry him, and then he slipped off to go whaling again. And so she cut her hair short, and she bound her breasts, and she conveyed herself as a whaler and got on board a ship and sailed around the Horn. And it wasn't until they were somewhere off in the Pacific Ocean off Peru that all of a sudden she got sick from something and had a fever. And in the process of administering her, the captain and crew discovered that she was a woman and freaked them all out, of course. But that was pretty much it. Mostly it was a very male-dominated profession. Hmm.
Well, in addition to all that we learn about the whaling industry, which is considerable, your great-great-grandfather, when his ship reaches New Zealand, actually leaves the ship and goes ashore and takes up logging. And of course, this is painful to read too, I'm sure. The fact that this was a logging operation involving a primordial forest there, and so these immense, marvelous trees, which had been there for who knows how long, were taken down in these logging operations. But nevertheless, this is something that he did for some time. We don't have a lot of time, but can you just briefly address why your great-great-grandfather made this shift for a time into logging and what you think that experience was like for him?
He definitely describes being, I think, a little bit tired of just being on the whale ship and the same people, the same crew. And he also has the first of his two self-realizations that he's not going to get a lot of money. And he realizes that for all the whales they've brought in and what they're charging him for being on the ship, he's got about $5 in hand. So he decides to get off in New Zealand, and he first goes up to the north end of North Island and logs these great kauri trees, which are considered, a religious element of the Maori society in New Zealand. And they're as spectacular as you will. They're as spectacular as the sequoia trees. I've been there and I've seen them, and they're very touching. And he logs there for a year and a half, and then he heads to the south end of North Island, Hawke's Bay, and he logs really what's a tall pine there. It's a little easier to cut. But in that area, he actually lives along the Maoris, and it's a fascinating, deep dive into their life and times, and I add to that in the context of the book, but it's a, you know, fascinating cultural history of New Zealand today. And then he finally realizes from there that it's time to go home, and in many ways, I think that's when he probably had his first epiphany internally that it was time to seek redemption and time to go home and get on his going. Because if you think about it, and I went there a couple of years ago to visit the site, it is the antipodes to where we are now. I mean, it is the exact opposite end of the world, No one in his family knew he was alive. No one knew where he was. And there he is, as far as you can be away in time and place. And he finally comes to realization it's time to head home. Mm.
And of course, one thing that is also amazing about your great-great-grandfather's story is that it's actually very seldom, or it seems like it's very, very seldom, that people manage to achieve this journey of redemption. I mean, far too often, people find themselves kind of falling into this black abyss of addiction, alcoholism, whatever it may be, and never find their way out again. And somehow your great-great-grandfather did. And of course, you're grateful for that for a number of reasons, but partly because that's one way that you're here today to talk about him. But it's an amazing story simply on that account, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I have to admit, it opened my eyes. When I sort of first got into it, and I have grown up with a bunch of friends, and many have struggled with substance abuse, and some of you said have, as you said, have come back, and some have not, and some continue to struggle with it. And it really opened up my eyes to substance abuse in the sense that I sort of thought it was really a matter of self-determination and that anyone should have the strength. And I realized that's not the case, and that there are people who are captured by the sort of physiological, deeper chemical elements. And it is not always easy, but some people it's almost impossible to break. And it is deeper than just having that kind of self-determination, and that often it is, you know, really is a biochemical issue. Mm-hmm.
Well, one way or another, your great-great-grandfather does return home and ends up having a successful career, married with children, a fine upstanding member of the community, and eventually passes away in 1902. And his story lives on now in this fascinating book that you have crafted, A Whaler at Twilight, a long-lost true account of whaling and redemption in the South Pacific, published by Lions Press, and the author, Alexander R. Brash. Thank you so much, first of all, for giving the world this fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. It was great to talk with you.
Barry, it was a great pleasure. Thank you very much. And if anyone wants to know more, you can go online and see to alexbrash.com. And there's more details about the book and background, and also the ability to buy it.